brought to you by the Fetzer Institute, helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world. Hey, welcome everybody to the Wonder and Awe podcast, A Journey into the Soul. I am so happy and thrilled to be here with my dear friend, Lynn Twist. She warms my heart because she's a true Jedi eco warrior, peaceful warrior, and she is so committed on missions to really help make the world a better place. She writes books, she inspires people, and I can honestly say she's one of my most favorite people on the planet. So welcome, Lynn, to Wonder and Awe.
Oh, thank you so much, Louis. You're one of my favorites too. Thank you so, so much.
In this love fest, one of the things I do want to ask you about is you describe yourself as a pro-activist. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's the term activist, and I have enormous respect for the thousands, millions of people who are in activism right now, and I recommend it. I am a particular kind of activist. I call myself a pro-activist because I'm an activist for, not against. And that sounds a little bit naive, maybe, because, you know, there's stuff in the way that's like a problem. Right. But if what pro-activist means to me is I stand in my vision, commitment to the future, that's where I stand. I know there's stuff in the way. I'm not attacking the stuff in the way. I am hopefully skillfully and with some respect helping just dismantle that which stands between us and the future that we dream of. You know, I sometimes use the term hospice, the death of the old culture and systems that no longer serve us while we midwife the birth of those that will.
So I have a suspicion that this your knowledge and your truth comes out of life experience. I think that in your latest book, Living a Committed Life, I think you describe the incredible adventures, stories that have unfolded for you in your life. So can you just share with us, like, how did that, you know, shape your worldview?
You mean the experiences I've had? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, the experiences you've had and how you can sort of, and how you came to the conclusion that through all those experiences, living a committed life is what we need to do.
Well, it might be a little bit the other way around, frankly, because I was lucky enough to know Buckminster Fuller back in the last century. Bucky was often called the grandfather of the future. He was an extraordinary human being who devoted his life to see if one human being, one little individual, he called himself, could make a positive difference that would impact all of humanity. And he not only accomplished that, in my view, but he lived that and inspired me and many millions of people to make a commitment out of their life to create a world that works for everyone with no one and nothing left out. To create a world that works for everyone with no one and nothing left out, that is a big commitment. That's not something you can check off, you know, at the end of the day or even in your own lifetime. And that commitment actually shaped my experiences rather than my experiences gave me that commitment. In other words, when you make a big commitment, that's kind of the point of my book. It takes you out of your little life starring you with all your worries about yourself and your woes and do people like me and have I made enough money and I'm going to be okay or not okay. All of that noise in your head moves to the background, and what moves to the foreground is your commitment to end hunger, to make the world a better place, to preserve the Amazon rainforest, to make extraordinary visual impact with your photography and your filmmaking like you have. And when you really make a big, giant commitment, it draws you into who you need to be. It gives you the experiences you need to have. It brings the people that are the right collaborators just right at your doorstep. It's just amazing what commitment does. And without commitment, we're sort of navigating a troubled world, trying to figure out where we fit in or why we didn't get what we wanted. But when we make a big commitment, it's like putting a North Star or a bow on the boat. And then suddenly it's this. And so I feel my committed life has given me the extraordinary experiences I never could have planned for myself, like learning at the feet of Mother Teresa, like being at Nelson Mandela's inauguration, like working in Ethiopia after the famine with some of the most extraordinary people in the world who went through that famine and lived to tell about it, working with the Achuar and the Shiwiar and the Zapara people and the Andoans in the Amazon. These are not things that I planned. These are things that came to me or I became engaged with in service of living a committed life. So that I think it works more like that than the other way around.
I totally agree. Actually, that's how I made Gratitude Revealed. You know, there was a commitment to make a film about gratitude after I heard Brother David. And as you said, everything unfolds based on following that path. You know, I literally ran into people on the road. That great scene we have with the rug weaver from Appalachia, Minnie Ann, she's looking out the window. I mean, she saw me at a gas station looking lost because I'm looking at a paper map, and saying, you're not from these parts. I go, well, I'm going to do this story about coal miners. And he goes, well, what's your name? I said, Louis Schwartzberg. And she goes, well, if I were you, I'd say your name is McCoy or McClintock before you go in those hills. And then, she just lit up in front of me. And then I said, when I come back, down this road, I'd love to stop by and, see the kind of, rugs you weave. And that opened up a whole beautiful, mindful story about work ethic, about being present. And actually, she had a great line. I don't think it was in the movie, but it resonates with a lot what you talk about regarding money. She said, I've been broke, but I've never been poor.
Oh, that's good. Oh, I love that. I'm going to use that. That's really, really good. I'm broke, but I've never been poor.
Yeah, because of her rich lifestyle, living in the mountains, her ancestry, her heritage, her culture. Mm-hmm. So share with me that philosophy that how money does warp a lot of people's, worldview in their lives and creates a lot of stress, anxiety. I mean, how can you really tap into the fact that it's energy?
Well, we live in a culture that is just been hijacked by money. In fact, it's almost like become the point of life. Like, you raise your children so that they can make money, or you get an education so that you can make money. Sometimes people even get married for the money. I mean, so we bastardized this wonderful thing called money and made it the point of life. And of course it's not. It's totally neutral. It is a current. It is a currency. That's why it's called a currency. It moves through every life. It's like water. It doesn't belong to any of us. It belongs to all of us or none of us. And it just moves around. And when it gets stacked up or overwhelmingly piled up, it floods somebody's life and they can't see any longer. They drown in it. We have people actually on the planet now drowning in billions of dollars and they can't remember who they are. They think they are their net worth. They think they are their bank account. They think they are their stock price. And if something goes down like an iota, their life is in danger almost. So also then we have people who are just actually healthy and well and prosperous and they love life and they have very little financial resources, but they're in touch with the natural world. I'm thinking of some of my colleagues in Africa or some of my indigenous sisters and brothers in the Amazon. They have everything they need. They're so grateful. The community takes care of itself. The community of life takes care of the community of the indigenous people. And they're not trying to accumulate anything. That would be inappropriate to the way they live. Nature doesn't accumulate. So we have a distorted relationship with money. You and I'm not pointing at you and I, I'm saying you and I like everybody, because we swim in a culture that tells lies about money, to put it pretty strongly, makes promises that can never be fulfilled with financial resources. Yes, it's wonderful to have more money. It's wonderful to have good resources. It's wonderful to have, you know, a secure feeling of your financial life. I'm not opposed to that at all. But we've been hijacked by this, you know, accumulation. You got to have more and more, 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 more. And everybody, including the billionaires I worked with, think somehow, gosh, if I just had 30% more, everything would be fine. Then you get 30% more, and then you think, oh, I really meant 30% more of this. And then you get there and you're, oh, no, I need 30% more of this. So we are caught in a hamster wheel in our relationship with money, when in fact, if you put money not in the foreground, like the point of life, but as a tool to actually empower the humanity, the service you want to render, the relationships you want to build, that are way more important than how much money they generate or how much money is involved in that, then money moves to the background and it flows through your life in and out in a way that is healthy. And so it's very, very, very hard to do that in a culture that exalts money above God, above the natural world, above our relationship with each other, makes it a culture that's made money more important than life itself, really, like no kidding. So that's a hijack, you know?
Yeah. But what's funny is a lot of times I think people feel they need more money in order to have freedom. You know, if I had X amount of money, I wouldn't have to work as hard. I would travel. I'd do vacation. But I think, and I've heard you say that in a way it limits you. I mean, in a way, a committed life and a life of purpose, if you're not stressing over the money, well, then you have more time and more freedom.
Exactly. You know, we often think that we need to keep our options open. You know, like, I want to make sure I keep my options open.
Right.
If you're about keeping your options open, I mean, that's healthy for a while, but you can have a whole life where you keep your options open. And it's almost like you're looking laterally all the time. Which option is the best one? And I'm not sure I want to choose this one because then it'll close off the other ones. And when you actually commit, one of the things that's beautiful about commitment and listening to a call and then answering it, is it sounds like it would limit you, but it actually frees you into fully expressing yourself.
Yeah.
And the same thing's true with money. When you know you are enough, you know, this whole thing about, do I have enough? Do I not have enough? Do I need more? There's not enough to go around. I have to make sure I'm not left out or the people I love are not left out. That mindset, that constant mindset of scarcity, as if there isn't enough to go around, which I say is patently untrue, has us behave inconsistent with our own humanity, has us accumulate way more than we need out of the fear that we're not going to have enough. And we do that to make sure that if you think that there's not enough to go around and someone's going to be left out, it's responsible to get way more than you need so you and yours aren't among those that are left out over here. And you know, someday you'll help these people over here that got left out, but you have to have way more than you need to even consider that. So it traps us in an us and them mentality. It traps us in a scarcity mindset when in fact, as Gandhi said, there is enough for our need, but not for our greed. But there is enough for our need. And it's actually not even an amount. I say that sufficiency is a way of being, a way of living, knowing not only that there is enough, I have enough, you have enough, we have enough, there is enough, but also the very profound experience, I am enough. And in the mindset of scarcity, it's not enough, we don't have enough, starts to be, I am not enough. And we have a deficit relationship with ourselves, which then we try to fill in with belongings rather than realizing we belong. So it's a very difficult thing to navigate the culture we live in right now. However, my radical surprising truth, not just about me and you, and I think it's true of you and me, and I think it's true of everybody, that there is enough, we are enough, we have enough, is a way of living, not an amount of anything. And when you live in that space of responsibility and the context of sufficiency, you're generous, you're in tune with what's needed and wanted, you take the path that is the most fulfilling and purposeful for you, and the universe does take care of you. You get taken care of beautifully, adequately, but in a way that doesn't foster greed, it fosters health and well-being.
I believe that 100%, but I'm just thinking there might be somebody out here listening who might say, well, what about that family that's, say, struggling, you know, financially right now and has it as a big burden? Does it make sense for them? And or how do they dig deep into themselves to find the resources they need?
Well, of course, there are many, many places on this planet where scarcity is a reality rather than a mindset. When I talk about it just a few minutes ago, I was talking about an unconscious, unexamined mindset that's sort of a frame of thinking that makes us behave inconsistent with our humanity. But I worked on hunger, as you know, and had a very close relationship with people on this planet who are living in resource-poor work circumstances. But what I want to answer your question with in a sort of a strange way, with a little bit of a story, because when I first started working on ending world hunger with the Hunger Project, we and many people around the world, and probably most people, use the word poor, that we were serving poor people. And I used that term until I met them. Once I met people that I used to call poor, I thought they were until I met them. And then I realized there's nothing poor about them. They're strong. They're resilient. They're unbelievably creative. They exhibit more courage to live through one day than you and I need in a lifetime. There's nothing poor about them. What's poor is their circumstances, not them. In fact, those poor circumstances sometimes foster an environment where they find a deep and profound inner strength, where their relationships with each other are truly prosperous and loving, where they value every piece of food, every gift they get from the universe. People who have a kind of profound gratitude that you've been writing about, making films about, that Brother David has talked about his entire 96 years. There's a great fullness that they feel in who they are. They're not confused by money and baubles and possessions. And so I never call people poor any longer because I know it's not true. A person cannot be poor. A person is whole and complete. Their circumstances may be poor, but not them. And they live in the ebb and flow and often tyranny of poor circumstances, but they're whole and complete. And the same thing with people I used to call rich. You know, I used to think they were rich, but no, they're whole and complete people living in the world of excess resources, which has its own tyranny, its own ebb and flow and fears. So people are just people. And when we label them poor or rich, we demean them and those of us who would call them that, because that's not who they are. So I find that working in places where people don't have enough water, enough food, enough employment opportunity, yes, that's very, very real. But the people are enough. What's not enough is their circumstances. And we can do something about that. We can do something about that. And those people in particular that I'm thinking of now, and I can name names like Mohammed and Malika and Syria, these are people that I know personally, millions of them really, I mean, millions, thousands of them that I work with the Hunger Project, who have a sense of their own enoughness that you and I take workshops and write films and books and everything to find. That's just who they become or who they are in the first place. And it gets validated by the strength and resilience of living in circumstances that are difficult. So yes, money's wonderful. It's great. It makes life easier. But if we think about when we've really had to deepen our character is when we fell on hard times, not just financial hard times, but difficult times. So there's a lot to be said for living in circumstances that aren't overwhelmingly abundant. So there are people who don't live in abundant circumstances, and I've been working with them my whole life.
Well, I actually witnessed that when I filmed in Dharvi, which is like in the middle of Mumbai in India. It's like the largest, you know, sort of poverty center in all of Asia. And before I walked in there, I was thinking, oh, this is going to be really rough, you know. And I go in there, and what I discover is that it's like a beehive. There's all these complex relationships where people have built these little boxes on top of each other next to this financial district in India, which is like exploding. Yet they don't want to move. They don't want to live in a different place. They have an ecosystem that thrives where everyone's got a small thing, but they have like, you know, dozens and dozens of connections, you know, with work and family. And you could experience the fact that they were joyful, that they had a ton of gratitude, that they would offer me food and water, you know, and it was clean. Yeah. So, you know, our preconceived ideas, you know, sometimes need to be shaken up a little bit. And I totally agree that what people spend a lot of money going to workshops for, in terms of learning about gratitude and appreciation and all of that, you know, is something that they have. You have a great line too. I think you also have said, which sticks in my brain as a mantra, to appreciate what appreciates, or did I get it wrong?
What you appreciate appreciates.
Yes.
And that's really, you know, you're such a role model for that, because when you think about how important gratitude and appreciation is in life, when you, no matter what your circumstances are, if you deeply appreciate what it means to be alive, if you deeply appreciate what it is to have food on the table, if you deeply appreciate how much you love your husband, your wife, or your daughter, or your son, or your friend, in the nourishment of that appreciation, what you appreciate actually does appreciate and grow in the nourishment of your appreciation. Like if you really appreciate, I just had some soup just before we started this, and I found it in the refrigerator of a friend where I'm staying, and I was so hungry. Every bite was so nourishing and delicious. And the more I appreciated it, the better it tastes for me. And when you appreciate, you know, when you take a look at your child, your beautiful baby, or even your puppy, or your cat, or your, you know, the orchid sitting on the desk, and you really pay attention to it and appreciate it, it expands your experience of that appreciation. It grows in the nourishment of your appreciation, and so do friendships and relationships and everything. So that's where prosperity lives, not in more, which comes from thinking you don't have enough and you got to get more. Prosperity lives in the appreciation, the gratefulness of what you already have. That's how we prosper. And we prosper out of sharing that. It's no fun to just have it like Ebenezer Scrooge and count it up and accumulate it. No, what creates prosperity is sharing it. And you share it when you feel there is enough. And then it starts to overflow into what I call gratefulness. Gratefulness. That's a Brother David quote.
Yeah. Well, and I learned that by filming in the mycelial network. You know, here you have this beautiful shared economy under the ground, you know, where trees share nutrients and communication and nurture their young in a shared economy without greed for ecosystems to thrive. So they, as you said, by nourishing each other, they nourish themselves, mm-hmm. you know, and that, mm-hmm. and that is a beautiful blueprint. It's also, I believe, the more of the feminine side of nature, mm-hmm. at least in terms of the stories that I love to tell, pollination, fungi, you know, these are stories of cooperation, of billions of intersections on a microscopic level that we often don't take or appreciate, that we take for mm-hmm. granted. And so I know you're also, you know, a champion for, you know, empowerment of the female voice. And I support that, but I support it from an interesting point of view that I've observed nature. And I believe that's nature's operating instructions, nurturing, networking, communication, you know, rejuvenation of life. That is the grand story. And unfortunately, in natural history filmmaking, I will comment that most of it has been macho, and it's been a lot of predator versus prey, survival of the fittest, the doggy dog. There's that does exist, but that is not the whole story. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that gets ratings. And, you know, that's why my films are different. You know, it's about beauty, like you said, you stare at that rose and the rose gets more beautiful. You take a bite of that soup and it just tastes more wonderful because you're tapping into this, you know, well, here we are, a sense of wonder.
Yeah,
you're wonder and awe. You're blissing out on it and being present with mm-hmm. it. You know, you're being totally present with it. And mm-hmm. I know you're a champion for the Amazon and the Pachamama Alliance, the feminine voice. I mean, for me, that is the story. That's the new narrative that mm-hmm. we need to share.
I totally agree with you. So I'll just say what I think you may have heard me say before, but I have an experience that this is the Sophia century. And if you think about it in the long view, which is what I learned from Buckminster Fuller, this is the first century of the third millennium. If you think about it that way, it's the beginning of something extraordinary. We're barely 23 years into the third millennium. You know, the turn of the century wasn't the turn of the century only, it was the turn of the millennium. And if you think of this first century of the third millennium, there's some many prophecies, but one that I really love is that this is the Sophia century, the century when women will take our rightful role in co-equal partnership with men and the world will come into balance. And also, this is the century when the divine feminine will rise and emerge and show up both in women and in men. And it's not that men have been wrong and bad and women are good. No, we aren't fully expressed, either one of the yin or the yang, as fully expressed as we can be now. And the prophecy that I love so much that I may have shared with you before, but is a prophecy from the Baha'i people that says, the bird of humanity, I'm going to move back a little so that you can see my arms. The bird of humanity has two great wings, a male wing and a female wing. And the male wing has been extended, fully extended for thousands of years. And the female wing has not yet been fully extended. It's been sort of folded in, not yet fully self-expressed. While the male wing has been fully self-expressed and fully extended for thousands of years, hundreds of years, and thousands of years, and it's become very muscular and developed and then overdeveloped and is actually, to keep the bird of humanity afloat, has become a little bit violent. So the bird of humanity for hundreds of years, according to this prophecy, has been flying in circles until the Sophia century, when the feminine wing in all of us, in women and in men, will fully extend itself. The male wing in all of us can relax a little bit, and the bird of humanity, for the first time in hundreds of years, will soar. And I love that prophecy because it doesn't make anybody wrong. It just says we're ready for the next evolutionary leap in what it means to be masculine and feminine and put that in balance, all of us. And, you know, women or the feminine tends to birth and the masculine tends to build. And we've been building, both, you know, physically, geographically and materially for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's now we're overbuilt, you know, we're overbuilt on the earth, we're overpopulated, we're overbearing, we're overdoing it, we're overconsuming, we're over. Whereas what we need to give birth to, I believe, is a new kind of human being. It's time to evolve. It's time to take an evolutionary leap. And that's birth is a feminine quality. It's a collaboration. It's a co-labor with men and women. You can't have a baby without a man involved in there somewhere. There's all kinds of new tricks about that. But, you know, basically... So it's a co-labor. We're co-laboring a new kind of human being into existence. We're pregnant. And I even think the pandemic, I often say this, was morning sickness for a species that's pregnant and ready to be reborn at a new level of evolutionary consciousness. And that is, you know, I can't prove this, any of this stuff, but for me, it's hopeful. For me, it allows me to fully express myself. It gives me a vision for the future. And without vision, the people perish. You know, that's a wonderful phrase from the Bible. And pain does push until vision pulls. That's what happens when you have a baby. The more it hurts, the closer you are to having a baby. If you didn't know you were having a baby, you would think you were definitely very, very ill because it hurts. But the vision pulls you through the pain. And so for me, having a vision that we're actually giving birth to a new kind of human being that's grateful, appreciative, really, really in touch with and present to the awesome wonder and beauty of life, which is, you know, this is your theme, Louis. This is what you photograph. This is what you bring to us with your incredible lenses that are your eyes. What you see is the world that we all want to see. So that's, to me, what's happening on Earth right now. And the feminine and the masculine are finding a new balance with each other so that we can fly.
I love that. And thank you, Lynn, because I, you know, when I capture these rhythms and patterns of nature that touch my soul, it's not just my soul, it's everyone's soul about that, because it is a fingerprint of the energy of the universe, you know, ocean waves, manipulated by the moon, manipulated by the sun, the weather, you know, these are just rhythms and patterns that are out there. And I love the fact that we all sort of can have an agreement on, like, what is beauty? You know, why are kittens cute? Why are puppies cute? This whole idea about the feminine of nurturing your young, we're hardwired to do that. So when I tap into that beauty, quote unquote, I think I'm tapping into life force energy, which guides us or inspires us to shift our behavior to do the right thing. Not to fall in love. Fall in love with the planet. Then you can do the right thing. You don't have to, like, just tell people the environmental degradation in terms of data, which makes people feel hopeless and turns them off. That messaging obviously hasn't worked, but if we can turn them on, we're hardwired to do that. You know, I mean, how did we for millenniums figure out this incredible genius thing called reproduction? But that, you know, it's not about your life. You know, we are, you know, just a link in the chain. And guess what? It's like, that's unstoppable. It's not like a civilization or a people are ever going to go, let's just stop right here. You know, it's been going on for a long time. The idea of one generation to another generation. And that is, I think, driven by beauty. What do you think?
I think that's just spot on. You know, this wonderful word that that is now in the lexicon more frequently than ever before, regeneration, that is the name of Paul Hawkins, one of his most recent masterpieces, Regeneration, How to End the Climate Crisis in One Generation, is such a powerful concept. It's different than and much more powerful than sustainability. Sustainability, although absolutely an important stepping stone to regeneration, was kind of like, let's not let it get worse. Let's keep it going. Let's keep it going. Let's keep it going. That's not only what that means, but of course you can interpret it that way. And that's not that very inspiring. But we created the problem of climate crisis. It's so clear. Even the climate deniers, you know, you can't even hear them anymore. They're so off the stage left, thank God. Even they know that we, this species called human beings, we created this crisis and we can resolve it. We created it and we can end it. And I'm a big advocate now for actually generating the conversation to end the climate crisis, not mitigate it, not try to have it not be too horrible, not hide from it, not, you know, work as best we can to make it not so horrible. No, end it. End it by 2050 or sooner. End it. That means returning to pre-industrial levels, what's called the Holocene. We're now in the Anthropocene because we're so powerful as human beings that we're, you know, screwing everything up. And we can do that. And there's so It's so clear we can. And the big missing ingredient in it is the will. And one of the things that will comes from is love and beauty and wonder and awe, being so in touch with that, that you take your life and realize that it's actually at stake. And when our life is at stake and we know it, we can do anything. We can do anything. We have enormous, enormous power when we commit ourselves. So I'm very in touch with how these crises, the climate crisis, the economic crisis, the health crisis, the school crisis, the government crisis, the democracy crisis, as Paul says, Paul Hawken, it's not happening to us. It's happening for us. It's happening for us, fostering an evolutionary leap, calling on us to be bigger and bolder and more transformed than just getting a little bit better every year. No, taking the leap as a species, as a human family, as a community of life.
But I think it's also so critical what you said, what most people sometimes miss, is that sense of wonder and awe that creates the commitment that we have to have unconditional love, because then it's unstoppable. Your energy is unstoppable. And like you say, if your life depends on it, I had a little medical scare recently, and I have doubled down on everything I want to accomplish. When all of a sudden it became kind of scary that you're starting to think you're standing on the edge of a cliff, there are a lot of easy things to figure out, like where does your money go and where does your house go? But where does your mission go? That was the hard one, to ponder and to figure out. But it may now that, I mean, everything's great, but now I'm more committed than ever. I'm more grateful than ever because I fucking had to face that thought of the most important thing is your mission. And we've learned from science that people who have purpose live longer. The blue zones, evidence of all of that. So then it goes and it reinforces your whole vision about the commitment. Therefore, not only are you helping others, you're helping yourself.
It's really exciting also, Louis, and I'd say this because you and I are probably around the same age. I don't really know how old you are. I know we're very young, but
we're also unstoppable.
Yeah. There's a wonderful man named Ken Dykewald. You may know him. He talks about the age wave. And he says he does a lot. He's been doing research for, decades on the baby boomers. And the baby boomers, or the generation right around you and me, is more living longer, more actively, more engaged in the world, making a greater contribution than any generation in history who's gotten up north of the 60s, years old. And I'll just say, for me, I know I have a lot of respect for people who spend their whole life getting retired and finding a place where they can go. I've got to move a little bit here. I'm in a house and someone is coming home with a little darling little girl. I have a lot of respect for people who are retiring and have the wherewithal to be retiring to their place where they can play golf and kind of rest. But I'm refiring. And I love that. And I think a lot of us, like you and I in our age group, we have so much more to contribute now. We've got experience. We have knowledge. We're fearless. We know the ropes. And we're here to make the difference all the way till the end of our lives. So I love that about the times we're living in, too.
Hey, look, you're in Northern California. I lived in Elk. All I want to say is that now that we have the benefit of hindsight, like what happened in 1970 at Earth Day, I just want to say that when people make fun of hippies, we were right. We were right. I mean, we talked about, no pesticides. We talked about, women's liberation, the movement for, racial justice for brown people and black people. Being open-minded about psychedelics. I mean, building your community, living off the land, having a small footprint, climate change. I mean, where were we wrong about anything that we were predicting, and science was certainly predicting at that time, but we wanted to change the world. You know, we stopped the war in Vietnam. It was a big thing. Got it, you know, removed a president that was waging, you know, an unethical war. Yeah, it's been a long road. But you know what I feel? Because maybe I'm a filmmaker, I feel the technology, for me at least, is catching up with the vision. I can now go straight to you, and you to me, and us to the world, without gatekeepers. You know, that's an example of miraculous breakthroughs that give us a lot of hope, you know, yeah, if we can use it all like in the right way. And the fact that, you know, the battleground now, I believe, is a battleground of consciousness. It's a battleground of attention span and eyeballs. You know, that becomes the currency. And then for the first time in the world, we've lost this idea of journalism. What is true, what is false, is like nobody knows, because of everyone is a journalist or has, you know, the ability to have that. So these are really kind of like crazy times, but times when maybe folks like us and others that are like-minded like us need to, you know, I guess put that vision out there, you know, celebrate life. You can change, we can change this whole thing with climate change and generation. It's just a matter of willpower. And consciousness, which shapes behavior. It's not about facts. It's not about science. It's about our hearts, not our heads. And that there's, you know, and I think we're doing it. I think there's a movement out there. I mean, the younger people are more committed to environmental causes than ever, you know?
Yeah, I think we have also the benefit of multi-generational collaboration like never before. You know, 3, 4, 5 generations being healthy and well in one family, but even not in one family. Like I'm in a home in Brooklyn that I'm staying with, and one of the little ones came home. That's why I had to move. She's 5, and the couple is in their, you know, 30s, and I'm in my 70s, and we are working together like this on all kinds of things. And they have a real commitment to the millennial and Gen X generation. I have a real commitment to all generations right now. But I also bring a lot of the people in my generation to the table who have experience and wisdom. You know, I was thinking about, I don't know why I want to say this, but I remember, and maybe you remember, way back there, I remember when President Kennedy said, "We're going to put a man on the moon within 10 years and bring him safely back to Earth. We're going to do that." The materials weren't invented. The whole idea was absolutely impossible. We had never seen the Earth from space. You know, it was just incredibly courageous to say that. But he didn't just say it. He committed to it. And then this thing called NASA was born. You know, it was 60 people in the beginning. It ended up to be 60,000 people. Materials were invented. Geniuses who had never thought before in a particular realm of aeronautics and aerospace. Aerospace came into existence. Astrophysicists became the key players. You know, it was just the commitment created the reality. And then just to remind myself of and you of this too, then, of course, he did accomplish that. We accomplished it. The whole world did. And it changed the game to see the Earth from space. It changed the game to have human beings walking on the moon. But it also gave us the perspective that we lacked, that we needed to understand our relationship with the whole Earth. And it was after that that Kennedy, our president, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy were all assassinated within 5 years. 4 of the heroes of my generation when I was in college were killed and assassinated within 5 years. So it was like a knife in our hearts. Another one, another one, another one. That could have set our movement, the movement to end the war, the movement for civil rights, the movement to begin looking at women's rights, all of that. It could have set it back, but it didn't. It propelled it forward. And I look at that, the strength of going through the challenges that built character for a generation of people, and I hope I'm one of them. The challenges we're facing now are even bigger, and they're developing a kind of character. We don't, you know, we can't count on the media the way we could before. There's no Walter Cronkite, you know, telling us like it is, and Tom Brokaw. No, we have to figure out our own truth. And there's something about that's pretty annoying, but it's also deepening our character. There's something happening that's forcing, in a good way, humanity to rise to a new occasion of truth, integrity, relatedness, vision, what it means to be human. And it's harsh feedback from the earth. You know, she's giving us major, major feedback. And if you look at it as feedback, we're not victims of anything. We're being given feedback. It's happening for us, not to us. And we can listen and make those changes. We know what to do. We know how to do it. We just need to do it.
Yeah, it's like looking into a mirror with Mother Nature, and she's saying, you're not living in harmony. Just do that. Harmony with nature, harmony with yourself, right? Just, you know, that, and there's a blueprint out there how life does flourish. So don't poison it, you know, don't hoard it. Just, you know, figure out how to make it, you know, thrive and regenerate, right? That's the trick. But guess what? We don't have to figure it out. It's right there. So again, back to the obstacle of shifting consciousness to shift behavior so that we're all doing things in the right direction, you know. But I also agree with what you said, that these challenges, maybe it does force people to come up with their own, explore their inner voice for their own point of view of what it means to be spiritual, what it means to be, you know, even religious and all of that. We have to, I think, figure that out on our own, and we can't maybe fall into lockstep, which is where everyone does the same thing and we all end up in trouble.
Well, there's another thing that occurs to me to say to you because of really talking about the intergenerational strength that we have now with the age wave, with people in my generation and yours living longer and healthier lives and being so engaged in the world. I mean, you know, there are people in West Palm Beach and Palm Springs and all those places just playing golf, but there's a lot of people who are still on the playing field and playing maybe harder than ever. I hope I'm one of them. But I'll just refer to Buckminster Fuller again, the great Buckminster Fuller, who was one of my greatest teachers. And he said, never forget your children are your elders in universe time. They've come into a more complete, more evolved universe than you'll ever understand except through their eyes. And I remember he said that to me when we were at home having dinner with my kids, and my daughter said something really profound, and she was only 8. And he turned to Bill, my husband, and I, and he said, you know, never forget your children are your elders in universe time. I thought, wow, what a concept. And even though, you know, it takes, I have to have my granddaughter helps to help me turn on and off the TV and find Netflix and all that stuff. I don't mean just that, although I really appreciate that, or how to, you know, work my iPhone when it gets stuck. But they also are carrying a different view of life and the world. And of course, they're facing challenges that we didn't have. Perhaps we had the nuclear challenges, but you know, the extinction of life on Earth wasn't exactly, you know, that clear then. And now you can see that young people really need to consider, do I want to have children? Do I want to bring kids into this world? At the same time, there's a deep, deep, deep consciousness in these generations. And elderhood in universe time, if I can use Bucky's metaphor, that I trust the grace and guidance that put the stars in motion, that gave us life, is still operating in this universe. And it is bringing into existence that which needs to be guide our species, the human species, even the pandemic being kind of morning sickness for a pregnant species. It's giving us what we need to awaken to another level of who we need to be. And it's not going to be easy. It isn't easy now. It's not going to get any easier. But, you know, in wonder and awe of life, anything's possible. Anything's possible. And everything is possible. And that's why your work is so important. That's why your voice is so important. That's why the images you create are so important. That's why you're such a hero for so many people. And that's why you're a channel for people to touch into wonder and awe, because it takes them out of their little life starring them and all the little worries they have. And I don't mean that they're little worries. I mean, they're serious worries, obviously, but we're bigger than that. We're bigger than that.
And when you get involved in things that are bigger than you, not only do you help the world, you help yourself. That actually is another definition of self-respect. Mm-hmm. You can't just like yourself or love yourself because you think you're cool. You love yourself because you're purpose-driven and you have commitment. And other people reflect that upon you. They go, wow, Lynn, I really love the work you're doing on the Hunger Project and with Pachamama. Well, that gives you a lot of self-respect.
And the word respect is such a wonderful word because... If you break it down, it means re-spectate or re-see. In self-respect, if you are willing to engage in self-respect, you keep re-seeing more and more of who you are all the time. And when you live in respect and trust, you keep re-seeing who everyone else is more and more all the time. You get more and more engaged in the whole, in the truth, in the integrity of what it means to be alive at this special time in history. You know, I know you know Joanna Macy, and she's 96 now. She might be 97, but she 90 something. And she says that people, she says she's a Buddhist. So she has a Buddhist view, worldview. Mm-hmm. And also she's a physicist and also she's a systems theorist. She's just amazing. But she says souls are waiting in line to incarnate because the great profound transition is underway and everybody wants to be part of it. She says, I'm so glad I'm still alive to see it because it's underway. Yay!
Yep, I feel it. And I also feel like it's taken a certain amount of patience because we felt it, as I pointed out, let's say Earth Day 1970, you know? It's been a while, and you know, as we Jack Kornfield, you know, talks about trust is a big part of patience, trust in the universe that it unfold the way it needs to unfold when it does. But I am ready for the party. I've always had that vision. I am so ready to realize that this is heaven on earth. Why not? You know. And I'm ready to embrace that wholeheartedly, you know?
Yeah, I love that phrase, heaven on earth. You know, this phrase, my husband Bill has been starting to say this all the time. He said, you know, this phrase, for heaven's sake. Yeah. Well, the way he says it now is, for heaven's sake. Let's do it for heaven's sake. You know, in a kind of reverence and respect for what it means to be alive now, this awesome time in history. It's epic. It's not just like a new era. It's an epic time in history. And when everything's at stake, that's when life really gets exciting. You know, when you think about skiing and people who climb mountains and, you know, people who love to be in on the edge.
Yeah.
That's when we really, you know, discover who we are. You know, there's fear involved. Of course, there's worry involved. Of course, there's can I do it involved. But really, that's when we're tested in a way that we're fully alive. And I say this is a time to be fully alive, fully on the playing field. It's an all hands on deck time.
Yeah.
And I say that if you're alive today, you've got a role to play. It may not be a big role. It may not be a small role. It's just your role. And if you play it with all your heart, if you play your heart out, your life will be a miracle. And there's plenty to do and plenty to work on and plenty of opportunities, plenty of jobs on the playing field. So we're so fortunate to be aware of that. So we're so fortunate to be alive at this time. We're so fortunate to know that we're fortunate, which is what your work is too, Louis. Uh-huh. You make sure we know how blessed we are. And I love you for that.
I'm just trying to reflect how big your heart is. That's all. I'm just a big mirror for everybody to like look at these, you know, nature and remarkable but ordinary people and lean into it and see themselves and come up with your own takeaway, you know, without telling people like what to do or how to live your life, you know, just to be a beautiful mirror.
Yeah, well, you do that very, very well. And you do it not only with your camera, you do it with your being, you do it with your presence, you do it with your podcast, you do it with your interviews, you do it with your just, you know, attendance to life on this planet. So I feel lucky to be your friend and your colleague on this wonderful conversation. And also, I just think the more people see your work, the better the world is going to be. So I hope everybody Googles you all the time and watches your films and stays in touch with what you're doing, because I think you're a channel for beauty and awe, for wonder, awe and beauty. That's you tap into it and you make it available to all of us, and you highlight it and point to it and underline it and embolden it so we don't miss it. Because it's easy to miss it because we're on our little cell phones and we're in our little worlds, and you know, we miss it. We miss the beauty of life unless someone kind of jostles us and points to it and you know, puts it in front of us. And that's the gift that you give everybody, and certainly me.
Okay, one last question. A deep dive into how would you describe wonder?
Yeah, what a great question. Gosh, I think it is an aperture, an opening. An opening, a clearing for beauty. And wondering is inconclusive in the best sense of the word. Wonder is inquiry without answer. Wonder is presence and being in communion with aliveness. Wonder is, at least in my world, the tapping into the beauty of innocence, that the innocence that comes with childhood. Wonder is tapping into what's fresh and new and possible and exquisitely beautiful and inviting and welcoming and safe. And I love just thinking about the word. I have my husband's aunt wrote one children's book before she passed away. She was someone who lived with polio, and she was one of these people that was disabled who had such a love for life. Sometimes, you know, it takes a tragedy to have us realize how great life is.
Yeah.
And she wrote a children's book called I Live in Wonder. And I remember reading it to my kids when they were very, very little. And I remember their eyes would open and their bodies would straighten and their kind of little selves would, you know, kind of open like a flower when I was reading the words about what it means to wonder. So it's a beautiful word. And then, you know, people call things wonderful, which actually, if we think about it, means full of wonder. And I love it that we're living in a world that's full of wonder and that is wonderful. So that's at least my top of mind response to your beautiful question.
Oh, well, it's beautiful. I loved all those, you know, definitions. I love the fact that it actually made you pause to think about it, that you don't have an immediate, you know, answer, that you have to go deep inside and really explain what it feels like in the moment right now. Because tomorrow, your opinion or your definition might change. If you're in Brooklyn, you might see like a beautiful fire hydrant or a graffiti. And you're going to be filled with wonder.
I think I will. I'm sure I'll see a fire hydrant and some good graffiti. It's everywhere there.
Well, so Lynn, thank you so much for this conversation. I love how we can just sort of swim in that sense of wonderment and and gratitude, and highlight, you know, all the good things you're doing, and inspire people to have hope. There really is. I mean, quitting's never an option, no matter what.
Reminded.
And then another good phrase is a definition of hope is the difference between an optimist and a pessimist. An optimist is someone who has their sleeves rolled up.
That's good.
So, yeah. So on that really hopeful note, thank you. And I want to thank, you know, the Fetzer, you know, Foundation as well. They support so many great grants and groups that are, you know, helping to shift consciousness by building a spiritual foundation for a loving world. And thank everybody for joining us on this beautiful roller coaster ride of wonder and awe.
Thank you, Louis, and thank you for everything you do and be. And it was a joy, as always. It was full of wonder and awe and wonderful speaking with you.
Yeah, thank you. Brought to you by the Fetzer Institute, helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world.